Art takes, not hot takes. This is Everyone is Wrong, a counterintuitive pop culture podcast. I'm your host, Seth Sommerfeld. Thanks for listening. My guest today has midichlorian levels that are off the charts, lost all his money betting on pod races, and is not Natalie Portman's body double. He has broken through a trade blockade to stage his own Battle of Naboo in defense of one of the most openly hated movies of all time, George Lucas's 1999 blockbuster, Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. Everyone is wrong, but Jason Baxter isn't. Thanks for coming on again, Jason.
Absolutely my pleasure. I am thrilled that we have brought things full circle, so to speak.
For those unfamiliar, the very first episode of this podcast, Jason and I talked about the Star Wars sequels in relation to them being better than the Star Wars prequels. But since it's May the 4th and since Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, is getting a re-release for its 25th anniversary this week, we figured it would be a good time to just silo off The Phantom Menace and talk about it in and of itself. So with that said, there will be probably some overlap on points we have, like some of the quotes I have from critics are still the same because the things they said in 1999 were still the same when we started this podcast to now. So we might reference some similar points, but I do not have the ego that thinks everybody is going to listen to every single one of these episodes, and I like them to stand alone. With that background in mind, let's get into Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace.
Yes, please.
Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace is a space fantasy film that serves as the start of a prequel trilogy to tell the story of how Darth Vader came to be before the events of the original Star Wars trilogy films. The film was written and directed by Star Wars creator George Lucas, with another score from John Williams. The Phantom Menace stars Ewan McGregor as a young Obi-Wan Kenobi, Liam Neeson as Obi-Wan's Jedi Master Qui-Gon Jinn, Natalie Portman as Padme Amidala, Queen of the Planet of Naboo, Ahmed Best as the Gungan Jar Jar Binks, Ray Park as the devil-like Sith Darth Maul, and Jake Lloyd as young Anakin Skywalker, the boy that would become Darth Vader. The story kicks off with Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan sent to resolve a blockade of the planet of Naboo by the Trade Federation on grounds of taxation disputes. On the order of the mysterious Darth Lord Sidious, the Jedis get ambushed by Trade Federation battle droids, but escape to Naboo. There they encounter the bumbling Gungan Jar Jar Binks, who takes them to an underwater Gungan city. From there, they rescue Naboo's Queen Amidala from the capital city of Theed, but they have to stop on the desert world of Tatooine to fix a damaged hyperdrive while avoiding detection. Qui-Gon Jar Jar, one of the Naboo cruiser's droids named R2-D2, and Queen Amidala, in disguise as one of her own handmaidens, go into the city of Mos Espa looking for parts. They encounter the junk dealer Watto, who has the parts, but they can't afford them. Watto also has slaves, including young Anakin Skywalker and his mother, Shmi. Anakin Kitty flirts with Padme, and soon after, Qui-Gon senses the Force in him. Qui-Gon then launches a plot to win the parts he needs and Anakin's freedom if Anakin can win a pod race in the desert. During that time, the mysterious Darth Lord Sidious's apprentice, Darth Maul, is tracking them down. Annie wins the pod race, and the good guys barely escape Darth Maul's ambush. They head to the Republic capital of Coruscant, but bureaucracy gets in the way of swift aid to Naboo, and Qui-Gon cannot convince the Jedi Council to train young Anakin as a Jedi. This is especially frustrating for Qui-Gon because he believes Anakin is the prophesied chosen one who will bring balance to the Force, in part because he seems to be an immaculately conceived Force baby. Frustrated with their situation, the whole crew heads back to Naboo to try and free the planet and defeat the evil Trade Federation. The Phantom Menace was maybe the most hyped movie in film history when it initially came out because fans had been clamoring for new Star Wars movies since the original trilogy wrapped up with Return of the Jedi in 1983. The film also made a ton of technical advances in filmmaking and is actually an indie film because George Lucas self-financed it through merchandising deal rights. There was a lot of merch related to this movie, which we might touch on. Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace was released on May 19th, 1999, and it was a smash worldwide blockbuster hit, making $1.027 billion against a $115 million budget. And before we get into the reaction that people had about this movie, Jason, what was your personal experience with first seeing The Phantom Menace?
Yeah, I didn't see Star Wars on the big screen until the special editions.
Yeah, we should say that the special editions, George Lucas re-released the original Star Wars trilogy in anticipation of this movie coming out with some changed digital effects and things like that. But essentially, it was a lot of people's first chance to see the original Star Wars trilogy on the big screen. And then that led to the hype for Episode One being even higher.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, that was 1997, and this is, you know, one of the canonical 99 movies. I was hyped. I saw it in theaters, and I loved it at the time. You know, we were a little too old, maybe, to be totally in the tank for Episode One at that moment, or at least for what it was aiming for.
Right, because it's very much a kid's movie, and George Lucas will even say, like, he intended this to be a kid's movie, and it is definitely the most kid's movie of Star Wars. Like, even, I don't even have this in the critical roundup, but a lot of the negative reviews were like, this movie is, like, has no sex. It's, like, not sexy, and it's like, yeah, that's like saying that about, well, like, yeah, a Pixar movie.
I take issue with that, because also, like, you know, I don't want to see Padme and Anakin having sex when they're, you know, whatever, 10 and 5 years old.
I believe it's 9 and 14 as said in the Weird Al A Saga Begins.
Yeah, but still, I'm like, okay, I think we can just have like a fun little adventure story and not worry about that sort of thing. Basically, I think the critics mostly just wanted a Han Solo type. And I'm sorry, you're not getting that in these stories. And that's okay by me.
Yeah, and I should also say, when you say it's one of the canonical 1999 movies, that's little film nerd speak, because the year 1999 has a lot of very much landmark films like The Matrix, like this. There's plenty other to mentioned, but that's what you mean by 1999 movies, for those unfamiliar.
Yes, thank you for saying that. Yeah, 99 is unparalleled. It's on a level with like 1973 or something, but yeah, anyway.
As for my personal experience, I was very much a Star Wars kid before Episode One came out. Like, I also am, my birthday is 10 years to the date after the original Star Wars movie came out, so they would often release these around my birthday, including this one. So oftentimes, like, my birthday was, let's get a bunch of friends together and go see the midnight screening of Episode One or whatever. So that is absolutely what we did, and, you know, had a little toy lightsaber and dressed up and all of it. And yeah, it was very much like, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't like, oh, this is better than all three of the original Star Wars movies, but I definitely was in the camp of, you know, I enjoy this movie, and I'm excited to see where the next one goes, and there's parts of this movie that are really fun and really epic. So, you know, slightly kids' glasses, but not like, again, as you said, we're sort of in that age where we're not like, we weren't Anakin's age, but yes, we weren't also the old fans who get grumpy about this, which we will sort of segue into with some of the critical responses.
Oh, boy. Okay, yeah.
Well, at first, Episode One was received kind of pretty well in, like, the first week or so that it was released. People quickly turned against The Phantom Menace. It was one of, like, few times in the pre, like, social media era that I can remember not everybody, obviously, but large groups of people group hating a movie and that sort of being like the cool angle to be like, yeah, that's terrible. Like, you can make stand-up bits about how bad this is, and you can make, you know, talk show monologue jokes about how bad The Phantom Menace is, and everybody's like, yeah, we're all on the same page. That sucks. You know, among the things that people really didn't like, the acting is often cited as being very wooden, which is fair for a lot of it. A lot of people found the Trade Federation plots, the sort of minutia of all that, to be very boring, which we'll get into. And then there's the obvious thing, which, again, as we did it, defended on the past podcast, we're not going to defend it on this one, that there are characters of some of the alien races that are pegged as racial stereotypes, which, again, I don't think was George Lucas's intent. If you know anything about George Lucas, he's just like kind of naive, and I think did not realize that people would take the certain things to be racist in ways. But yes, that's a valid criticism of these movies that we will not be standing up for. The Phantom Menace sits at a rotten 52% among critics and a worse 41% among top critics, with a better but technically still not fresh 59% audience score. And as I get into these quotes, as I said, some of them are repeats from the last Star Wars sequel episode we did, because I'm not going to pretend like there's suddenly new ones, and the ones in retrospect that have been done don't really capture what it was like in the moment, and that's kind of what we're aiming for. Peter Travers of Rolling Stone said, "The actors are wallpaper. The jokes are juvenile. There's no romance, and the dialogue lands with the thud of a computer instruction manual." Mark Caro of the Chicago Tribune said, "No matter how much detail went into turning clumsy sidekick Jar Jar Binks into an expressive digital creation, he can't overcome Lucas's conception of him as an incomprehensible Amos and Andy type blubberer. Actually, he sounds most like a prepubescent mushmouth from Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids, who walks with an exaggerated pimp strut. He's not the only ethnic caricature either. The Trade Federation officials sound like stock Oriental villains." Wall Street Journal's Joe Morgenstern opined, "What I can't comprehend is why the political details had to be so tedious and abstract. Will the kids of our nation and the world truly be titillated by trade wars and the spectacle of a do-nothing Senate?" Peter Rainier in New York Magazine said, "George Lucas has been quoted as saying that actors are still the best way to portray people, but in watching his Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, you get the feeling he wishes it wasn't so, that he could dispense with actors altogether. Being human has never seemed more humdrum. And maybe this was Lucas's intention. By making his CGI creatures, his droids and globs and thingamajigs, so much more captivating than his people, he's striking a blow for the primacy of special effects over human effects. At this point in his career, he may not know or care about the difference." But to counter that bile, there's Everyone Is Wrong's staple critic, Roger Ebert, who gave The Phantom Menace 3.5 out of 4 stars, and as stated on the prior podcast, the lead of his review really rocks. It's one of the better film review leads you will find, and it goes a little something like this. "If it was the first Star Wars movie, The Phantom Menace would be hailed as a visionary breakthrough, but this is the fourth movie of the famous series, and we think that we know the territory. Many of the earlier reviews have been blasé, paying lip service to the visuals and wondering why the characters aren't better developed. How quickly do we grow accustomed to wonders? I'm reminded of the Isaac Asimov story Nightfall, about the planet where the stars were visible only once in 1,000 years. So awesome was the sight that it drove men mad. We who can see the stars every night glance up casually at the cosmos and then quickly down again, searching for a Dairy Queen." So Jason, why is everyone wrong about The Phantom Menace?
I would be hard-pressed to sum it up better than Ebert. I forgot how incredibly great that quote is.
It's so good. It's like such a good, just such a good piece of writing. Even if
It,
you don't, even if you don't like the Phantom Menace, that's good writing. Just.
yeah, absolutely. I think the Phantom Menace is phenomenal. Revisiting it today for this, I was just like, oh, wow. I mean, it sings on so many levels, and it looks great.
Yeah, it really does. It like considering how much of this movie was innovative in its use of CGI and CGI backgrounds and things like that, it holds up surprisingly well. Like there's so much like old CGI where you're like, "Ooh, yeah, this really like hurts the movie."
Yeah, sure. Your Mummy sequels and whatnot, and but like, yeah, it is. I would say like better looking than like most Marvel movies these days.
Yeah.
It's kind of wild.
It's at least less it's less chaotic. The Marvel battles, especially as those went on, just became like not quite
Mud.
to the level of Transformers, like I don't understand what's going on, you know, CGI battle fest, but it's just like, oh, it's nice that in this CGI movie it's like, oh, here's a lightsaber battle that's like choreographed and, you know, things like the pod race is so clean and you're not confused on what's happening, but we'll get into some of that later.
Yes.
Yes, to launch into your defense, I think your first point has to do with sort of the cast of this movie.
Yeah, it is kind of wild to think about some of the people that pop up in this movie that have gone on to do great things. Like Dominic West is in there as a Naboo guard, McNulty from The Wire. And then, most importantly, I guess I would say, is Padme's entourage.
Well, yeah, Padme's entourage has well, first off, I mean, even just like the main stars of this movie, it was something that like all these people were known at the time in terms of like the three main adult quote unquote leads of Padme, Obi-Wan, and Qui-Gon were all like established actors, but definitely.
Well, yeah, I mean, Ewan was like kind of established.
Right. I
Like
mean,
this
he'd
was,
been in Trainspotting and he'd been in like Emma and Velvet Goldmine. Like he'd been in a few things. Like he was familiar to like a film goer. He wasn't a like star. You want to like open a movie with Ewan McGregor. But yes, but that's the thing. This took him to another level. And as we kind of talked about before, it's just like he gets so much better as these movies go on too, and he becomes like
100%.
he becomes like by far the best actor. Well, outside of maybe Palpatine eating up scenes as it goes on, those two are like clearly head and tails above everybody else on screen in terms of just like acting and emotion throughout these.
Yes, they're the most invested.
But even, you know, Natalie Portman, you know, she was in Leon the Professional, you know, very early on, and then popped up in like Heat and Mars Attacks and things like that. But this was, again, her being like the centerpiece star, you know, buzzy, hot young actress who was also going to Harvard and having a lot of stuff
Right.
happening. So she gets elevated another level. And even Liam Neeson as Qui-Gon, you know, he'd been in Schindler's List, he'd been Oscar nominated, but he wasn't. To American audiences, he was not. This is well before Taken, and he was not like an action dude. He'd been in like Dark Man and, you know, other things. He'd been in Excalibur and Nell. So he was known, but he was not, you know, the Liam Neeson that people think about now in 2024. You know, nobody was like, you know, we need to get a gruff ass kicker. Who could do this? Liam Neeson was not at the top of the list.
No, that is a terrific point. So the handmaidens, Padme's handmaidens, something that also struck me on this most recent rewatch was like, oh, so Keira Knightley is Queen Amidala for like half the movie.
When Padme gets into, you know, I'm going to be the handmaiden who goes and does everything, then the fake queen is Keira Knightley before,
Yeah,
again,
it's Keira
well before
Knightley.
Keira Knightley was a thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And then Rose Byrne is the other handmaiden.
And there's also another handmaiden who's not known for acting except acting really bad in one specific movie.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. And that would it be Sofia Coppola?
That'd be a little Miss Sofia Coppola. Really stacked handmaiden cast.
I think that's just kind of fucking wild that Lucas built that deck with those folks.
Yeah, the casting agent was cooking that day, I guess, when they were,
exactly.
getting that band together. It's like, who are these mostly like wordless people, but are in a lot of the movie?
And they're either Australian or friends of George.
Yeah, basically. And that works out, it turns out. If you're scouting for talent, be friends with George Lucas or be a soon-to-be famous actress. So
and Roman Coppola is in the movie as well. So mm-hmm. yeah.
So yeah, there's a lot of like little things like that in addition to, you know, the big main headliners. There's more to this cast than meets the eye if you go and do an IMDb deep dive for sure.
But I'm glad you brought that up about Liam Neeson. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is weird. Like he's coming. What is 5 years after Schindler's List?
Yeah, but he hadn't had like anything on that level since.
He wasn't bankable.
No.
Yeah,
and even you know, even Schindler's List is not like people were like, I need to go to that Liam Neeson movie, Schindler's List. They're like, I need to go to the Steven Spielberg movie that's going to make me cry.
And that's probably why he got hired. I'm sure George was like, hey, Steve. I need a Jedi, a Zen Jedi. You got a guy? And he's like, yeah, I think I know a dude.
I know somebody who's good at saving children from precarious situations.
Saving. We'll put that in air quotes and save it for later.
Yeah. Moving on to your second point is one that we sort of touched on before, but I think gets more, we can deep dive a little bit more when focusing on this film specifically, which is sort of the politicking involved with everything.
Yeah. At the risk of repeating ourselves from the inaugural episode, it really gets my goat when people get mad about how political this movie is.
Mm-hmm.
And I get it. It's in the opening crawl, you know, all this verbiage is thrown at you.
Yeah, just on that point, the opening crawl, for those who haven't watched in a while, this is literally the first lines after the title and, you know, episode. It's, turmoil has engulfed the Galactic Republic. The taxation of trade routes to outlying star systems is in dispute. Like, those are the first two lines. It gets eight words before you're hit with taxation, which is always what you want in your space fantasy adventures. So, I mean, even, you know, I understand in a very, like, basic, like, ape brain sense, it's like, no, want lasers, not taxes.
Yes. Yeah, and I guess that's what I bristle at, is like, okay, so you want that. You already have that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have the interesting story about how capitalism bad and how it engendered this, you know, these literal wars.
Mm-hmm. And leads to fascism taking over everything.
Exactly. Yeah. It didn't bug me as a kid because I think The Phantom Menace, which this would be one of my, you know, crucial points, is it functions totally fine as like a escapism adventure movie.
Mm-hmm.
Worked on me when I was 12 or 13 or whenever. But revisiting it as an adult, I'm like, oh my God, yeah. No, this is actually like really intelligent in a way. Mm-hmm. In a way. And the prequels in general, just like, you know, Lucas being such a student of history and things, and you know, the originals are about Vietnam to a degree,
right?
And I think there's a lot of that in the DNA of The Phantom Menace and the other prequels.
Over the course of the prequels, a lot of commentary on the Bush administration and their policies.
Yes. Which, it wasn't necessarily on his mind, back in 98, but he was thinking about American imperialism. And I think that bears out in the movie because the Gungans are, an underclass.
Yeah, it's very much it's in the Star Wars tradition that George Lucas has always had of like going back to like Ewoks in the Return of the Jedi, that it's,
100%.
these natives of the land that are actually more capable and advanced than people give them credit for, and they, rise up to take down, sort of the evil oppressive force coming to take their land and use it for their own destructive purposes.
Who supposedly have, better firepower and all of these things. I mean, people forget that Lucas was originally going to direct Apocalypse Now. Instead, he made Star Wars movies.
Yeah. Like, it's not only the Gungans having this more natural way of living that ends up like triumphing over these like political sticklers at the top, but it's also the contrast between like the Gungans and the Nabooians, because or the humans of Naboo, however you want to put it, because they're all from Naboo. Like, they are, kind of not able to defend themselves because they are like, well, the laws and orders will keep us in check and everything will just bureaucrat our way out of it. And the Gungans are like, look, we have to take care of ourselves. We have to, if you just are able to not have this superiority complex over us, then we will help you. But you tend to do that. So maybe, like, it ends up working out, but that's all part of it.
Absolutely.
I think there's some other political points that are interesting to get into while we're on this topic. Like, again, sort of the dumbness of this all stemming from a, taxation blockade, and then it like leading to a takeover of the Senate and a destruction of the Republic and Darth Vader rising and this Emperor taking over. Like, that's Lucas's point in the prequels, not like a thing that he stumbled into. That it's just like, oh yeah, sometimes it's this little stuff that we like bicker over that's bureaucracy and stuff like that. And if we just like let it spin out, if we let people, get tied up in like Tea Party beliefs, then it spins out and eventually becomes Trumpian ideas and, becomes more and more like all that stuff. It's just like, it's right there.
That is the whole thing of it. Yeah, it does make me mad when people think it's like petty. I'm like, it isn't. Like, the point he is making with these movies, and it is more prescient than ever now, as you just pointed out, is like, yeah, it can be a little thing. It will be probably an economic thing. It'll be, the haves versus the have-nots, and it will spin out into something really bad. I mean, to make a kids' movie about that, I think it's pretty cool.
And I mean, also something you said earlier at this point, like, this movie does weirdly like stand up on its own. Like, you like it sets up that like, oh, there needs to be like sequels, but like revisiting it, it's not just like we're just like nailing it up for there to be the Anakin story. Like, you could watch this movie and not be like, oh, well, I need to watch the second movie immediately, or this none of this makes any sense. It's not like Marvel's Infinity War, like,
Oh, yes.
all the characters are dust now, bye. It's like, wait, what?
No, it wraps up well. And like, he could have not even made other movies. And, that would be fine. Yeah, no, it's a complete story and it is a setup, but I agree.
I will say that a few of the political things are a little bit like, wait, you guys are doing things very in a weird manner. Like, just on the face, Queen Amidala is an elected queen of a democracy, which is like, I'm like, okay. I'm still not 100% sure how that works because they also have, representatives in the Senate. That's Palpatine and stuff like that. So some of that's a little confusing. Jar Jar gets to be a general just by like, by accidentally negotiating peace, and then they're like, okay, you get to be the general for this like worldwide battle we have. It's like, wait, I don't know, like, you exiled him from being clumsy, maybe just like a medal.
Okay. in defense of that, Han Solo also gets made a general.
Yeah, but he gets a general after like intentionally doing good things.
He does one thing.
That's fair. Also, when they are in the Senate chambers and doing it, there is like a little bit of like logic gap, because the whole thing that like Amidala gets like hung up on is, and the like, that's the hang up in the Senate and why nobody acts, is they're like, we need to send a commission to see if like these claims that the people are starving and being held captive are true, which would make sense, except that the Senate sent the Jedis there to negotiate the peace deal and they got attacked and they've come back, and you should just probably be able to ask the Jedis, because they're sort of this independent police force in some ways, about like, hey, did you guys get attacked? And they'd be like, yeah, we got it. That's why we took so long and there was no agreement and you didn't hear from us and we have all this things. And they kind of just like, well, we need to send a commission. It's like, you did send a commission. It was Jedis. And that's one thing that like kind of is like, wait, what function were the Jedis in this whole thing, if they can't just like tell you, yeah, that's definitely being attacked, we had to save this queen right here and bring her to you because we were attacked.
I will allow that. Yeah.
Yeah. But overall, you know, the politics is sort of the point in a way, which is weird to insert it into a kid's movie, but I think it effectively works and continues to effectively work over the course of the...
That's my whole thing. I think it's good. Yes. And as you said, and as we elaborate in the prequels episode, the first episode, it only gets more overt and better. But yeah, like, put this shit in kids' movies. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I think more kids should be, you know, have a download of like, oh, capitalism bad. You know.
Yeah,
this is what is causing wars, that sort of thing.
Yeah. But speaking of things that do fit well in a kid's movie, there is one central scene that is very much your third point of defense.
Oh, yes. Fuck yeah. Okay. The pod race rocks. I don't know what else to say. And I've come to appreciate it even more now, becoming something of a George Lucas scholar and stuff. Like, he was a drag racer in Northern California back in the day and stuff.
Right. Obviously, American Graffiti comes up, and that's, you know, an homage to all of that. But he's very much like a car guy.
He's a car guy. He's a gearhead. And the pod race is such a fucking, I don't know, for like perfect sublimation of his fascinations. And something about the, like, the fact that it is just noise. It's, you know, Ben Burtt's sound design.
Whirring engines and crashes and whooshes. Oh, and
yeah. And in terms of visual effects, famously, not to cite another article I wrote for you, but I wrote about The Matrix, which also came out this year, 1999, that year. Phantom Menace lost the Academy Award for visual effects to The Matrix, which is,
yeah, it
I guess understandable, but like,
it's one where it's just like, it's understandable because The Matrix was definitely a better received movie and stuff like that. In terms of like actual innovation and degree of difficulty with some of these special effects, The Phantom Menace is a much more important to the history of special effects.
1,000%.
I mean, like, as we said, like, Jar Jar was the first like main character in a film that was all special effects, and he works and looks good. I mean, you don't have to necessarily like Jar Jar, but you're like, you're never like, this thing looks terrible. What are we doing? Like,
he looks good. Rewatching it today, I was like, kind of surprised, because I expected him to look like, you know, a little like waxy or something. No, like the effects, and especially the effects in the pod race sequence are just like,
it's just an effects action sequence. I mean, there's, you know, shots of etiquette. It is yeah. pod race and, you know, some crowd reaction shots, but it's pretty much just a huge CGI scene. And it's thrilling.
It's wild. And if there are like CGI haters in the listening audience or whatever, like a lot of the audience, that's practical.
Mm-hmm. Also, you know, watching this again, there's so many things about this, the Padres sequence, that really stick out. Like, first off, there's so much good foreshadowing before the pod race and then like during the pod race.
Yeah.
You know, the first time you meet you know, Jar Jar is walking around Mos Espa and gets caught up with Sebulba, and Anakin comes and saves him, and that's kind of how Anakin reunites with the crew. Foreshadows that. But even within the race, there's so many good things. There's the, you know, part that breaks beforehand.
Yeah, there's like little, God, I wish I can't come up with the term, but like little turns and moves where it's just like.
Yeah, because it's a.
It keeps you on the edge of your seat, like moment to
right.
moment.
It's a 3-lap race. And like the first time around, there's like, oh, you see fans watching from this ramp that eventually they have to go off this ramp. You see these Tusken Raider snipers that eventually become more involved. You see all these little things.
Or this thing breaks and then you have to fix it. And
yeah.
Then, yeah. It's so thrilling. Mm-hmm. And it's like the perfect thing to put in the middle of your movie. Mm-hmm.
And for all the creature lovers, you know, there isn't a cantina scene like in the original film in this, but this sort of serves as that. Like, we're going to throw a bunch of characters at you when they're doing the racer intros. There's like 9 racer intros.
Oh my God, love it.
And like, they're all like distinct characters with the distinct creatures with these distinct ships. And like, the announcers are saying like specific things about them. Like, oh, this guy's got such a unique, awesome ship. Or this guy has, you know, he's known for his like good pit droids that work on his thing. Like, they all have like a line or two, but it's just like, okay, well, that's that guy, that's this guy. They are introduced in a weird order where it's just like, okay, here's a couple guy, here's the favorite, here's the guy who's in the pole, and then like, here's Anakin last. It's just like, that's not typically how I think. It's very scattershot, but that's just a funny little you know, film only. It works for the script, but it would be very weird if you were at an actual race and they introduced anything in that sort of order. And, you know, there's other things that are very fun about the whole scene. It's like the,
Greg Proops.
Yeah, is one of the two-headed announcers.
Yeah.
There is some weird things. Like, Watto makes bets on this, and this is how they get, you know, how Qui-Gon gets the parts and all this. But, like, Watto, it's such, like, a good deal for him, and he's like even considering it, where it's just like Qui-Gon's basically like, well, if you win, you can just give us our parts and that's like it.
Yeah.
But we'll put up the like fee, and we will put up the pod, and we will use your slave racer. And it's just like, and he's still like thinking about it, and eventually it's just like, hey dude, this was, if you have a bunch of gambling debts, this would be a good thing to do. And then it is weird that like, apparently he bet so much on Sebulba that even though he won the race and gets all the race winnings, he's still like down in the hole, which is.
I was also wondering.
I'm like, wait,
this.
You should. I feel like winning the race should be cover all the bets. And he's like, I'm ruined. I'm like, I don't. You won like the purse of whatever this like massive, massive race is. So,
yeah.
And you. Yeah. All that.
There are aspects of the Phantom Menace that I cannot explain or defend, and that would be one of
yeah,
them.
Yeah, there are a couple of like other weird things. It's fun to like nitpick a little bit of this. Like, it is weird that like Anakin's face is like pretty clean throughout the pod race, and then when he like gets out of the pod, it's like a woolly willy beard of like dirt caked on his face, and then there's like a very bad "Mom, I did it" ADR that doesn't fit at all, and it's just like. You could tell, but you know, some of those little things. Warwick Davis is in this as a cameo in Watto's box. That's fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah, Warwick, I believe, is also like I can't remember the race of Greedo, but he's Anakin's buddy.
Yeah, in the when they're like prepping the pod and stuff like that.
Yep, yeah, yeah.
The one economic thing of like that doesn't make sense is, so as part of it, Qui-Gon wins the wins Anakin's freedom as part of this bet, because he bets on Anakin over Sebulba, and Watto takes the bet. And like Watto says that, like, because Qui-Gon originally tries to get both Shmi and Anakin, and Watto's line is like, no pod is worth two slaves. But then, which I get, but then Qui-Gon gets the Podracer back at the end of it and sells it and then gives the money to Shmi. But it would imply, like, the way that Watto set it up, a pod would be worth like one slave. So is he like, you can't use that money to buy Shmi? Shmi's freedom is a thing that is very, why doesn't she get freed at some point?
Well, we might get into that.
Yeah. It's just like, or even at the end of this movie, you think when, oh, Queen Amidala is back with the Naboo. Hey, this kid really helped us. You were really upset that, like, there were slaves out there. Maybe just use your, royal fortunes. Do you have royal fortunes because you're elected? But it seems like there should be some way to, like, overpay Shmi, and Watto can just get a different slave who doesn't have the attachment to one of the children that helped you save your planet. But that's a little like Han Solo, why don't you just go pay Jabba stuff?
Yeah, that's a good point.
But, you know, it's a theme throughout Lucas's plots. But overall, the pod race is so fun.
Can we just say, and this is also a generational thing, great video game.
Yeah, if you are in our age range, if you are in like your mid-30s, Star Wars Pod Racer on Nintendo 64, crucial game. It is a great game. It is very fun.
No, it's in the top three.
It's the top three N64 racing games, I would say, for sure. I would say it was Mario Kart 64, Diddy Kong Racing, and Star Wars Pod Racer are the three that are in contention for that title.
Well, okay, racing aside, I would also, if I'm just making like a top five or something, GoldenEye. Right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we could go into a whole side tangent. There's GoldenEye, there are a lot of great Nintendo 64 games, great console. And, you know, you could even go with the Rogue Squadron on Nintendo 64 is fantastic.
Okay. That could be a whole other episode. But, I'm very mad that that movie isn't happening.
Yeah, that's...
Or maybe it is again. Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah. But one thing I was going to say about the pod race and it being so fun is I'm pretty sure, and it was racking my brain, that this is like the first, because in the original trilogy, all the like big, large scale events are like wars and battles. Like the closest thing you come to is like, you know, in Return of the Jedi, how there's either like the Jabba scene, you know, or where it's like, oh, well, they're still just sending people out to die, or like the Ewok scene celebration at the end of Return of the Jedi, or the, you know, the celebration at the end of the original Star Wars. But those are very short, especially in the non-special edition versions, and they're like very, you know, defined to this like one specific place and not on this like grand scale. It's like, oh, here's this little rebellion having their celebration.
I am so glad you
but this is
up.
The first large-scale event that isn't like treehouse slumber party with the Ewoks or things like that. This is like a huge event that's like world-building in a way that really hadn't been done in Star Wars movies before.
Definitely not. Like I said, like it is just Lucas doing Lucas. Like, this is his jam. And it's actually, like, really fun.
Yeah.
You know? I think that is one of the things that is missing from those sequel movies. Because, you know, the dude isn't behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just people, you know, trying to do his vibe. It's like, his vibe is a bit different.
His vibe is hot rod racing, but in space.
Exactly. Yeah, which it turns out is super fun.
Yeah, but we should probably move on to our fourth point, which is sort of the Jedi Old Republic backstory building of some of the lore that takes place in episode one.
Yes, this is another thing that a lot of people have issues with that I don't totally understand. What is important to fathom about the way the Jedi are depicted in the prequel trilogy and in The Phantom Menace especially is that they are very dogmatic. I don't totally understand their vibe, but they're essentially like a religious cult that is kind of like the military of the government.
Yeah, they're sort of like the cleanup force. You know, they're essentially tried to be, you know, good cops for the galaxy.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how we meet them in Phantom Menace. I totally dig the depiction of them being at the top of their game. Like, that's a whole thing about the prequels that, you know, one of the, you know, innovative things about the original Star Wars trilogy in the 70s and 80s was like, oh, space can be dirty and like gunked up and stuff. The reason why it's like, you know, dirty and messed up is because there was this like, you know, Grand Republic that fell. And so the prequels are telling the story of like the fall of this great democracy. So, you know, we get to see the Jedi's at their peak, you know, aesthetically, the ships are cleaner, you know, all this stuff. Like, I think that is such a cool thing to have done in establishing what was to happen, you know, 20 years hence.
And also, you know, kind of going with that, you know, they're at the top of the game. They're also like the Jedi's, and it gets more as the sequels go on, but it's just like they're also, because they've been on top for so long in this timeline,
They're
they're
ignorant.
overconfident and like just can't imagine, like, you know, that it's presented like, yeah, we ran into a Sith, and they're like, there's no way we would have sensed if there was a Sith, and only Yoda's like, guys, like, we're not really in touch with the dark side of the Force. That's kind of like our whole thing.
Well, even Yoda
Oh,
effed
he
up.
F's up for
Yeah.
sure, but he at least, like, everybody's just like, no, Qui-Gon, what are you talking about? And he was like, hey, like, maybe, like, let's investigate it at least. And he screws up more as things go along, but you know, and there is like this, you know, part of, I think, some of the wooden acting is like this overconfident stoicism that the Jedi are trying to have, that Qui-Gon is like trying to have and stuff like that.
That's
And
a
some of it like
fantastic
just like doesn't, like, I understand what it's going for, but it is some of the things that like don't work, like when they are traveling through, you know, the planet's core underwater, you know, there's these huge like fish kaiju coming at them and Jar Jar's freaking out, but like Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan like have like no reaction during like any of those, basically. Like, they barely are like registering like, oh yeah, we're in grave danger. And I do feel like it takes away a little bit from like, yeah, it's harder to feel like they're in peril when they're like not presenting that they're in peril.
Well, okay, part of me wonders if that is their Jedi training.
I think that was the choice, but I'm saying that that doesn't necessarily translate well to like the average film goer to be like, hey, there's a huge like monster, like you guys are, and you guys are kind of just like staring flatly ahead and being like, yeah, we'll make it through.
Yeah, yes, I will admit that sequence is not
Yeah,
exciting.
and it should be.
Yes. It does look
Yeah.
good.
Again, it's just like it's a stiffness is the thing, but you know, that's sort of something that I think a reason why some people might like bounce against some of the this Jedi stoicism kind of stuff.
Yeah, but that's the whole point, is the issue. You know? It's like, okay. Like, the Jedis are kind of pricks. Like,
I think one of the big hang-ups was the whole introduction of midichlorians, which we should probably talk about, which are
oh, do we
we
have
do,
to?
which
Okay.
are like they basically set up that like, oh, there's these like force sensitive things that you can measure in your blood, and you know, you have more of it, and Anakin is off the charts when they measure his blood. I feel like maybe if George had a second chance, he'd be like, yeah, that was probably not necessary. We probably could have just been like, yeah, I could just like feel his force. It's like off the charts, or some other way that's not like inserting it into DNA is like a little like, oh, wait, so you're just like born into this, which I don't love. And it's sort of some of the stuff that, like, The Last Jedi touches on, I think, well. And, like, the, like, yeah, it doesn't really matter who you are. Like, it, you can be kind of from anywhere, but it's just, like, yeah, the Force isn't, like, picking and predestining, like, every single person to, like, be a Jedi, and you're screwed without it.
Seth, I love that for you. I have bad news for you. Before Lucas sold his company to Disney, he had plans for another trilogy, and they were all about midichlorians.
Yeah. So, yeah, maybe he doesn't regret it, but maybe he should. I don't know if it's the best thing, but I don't know. There's lots of things that, like, there are some Jedi things that are introduced here that are fun, that are sort of new. I mean, I like that, you know, even the at the start when, like, Qui-Gon's melting the door with his lightsaber, it's like, oh, cool, that's something I haven't seen a lightsaber do. Or or Watto shrugging off the Jedi mind trick. That's fun just because it's like, because it's like you have, again, something you haven't totally seen in, like, that direct of a manner.
What? It doesn't work on a Hutt. Right. But also whatever Watto is.
Right, but Watto does it so much more like, Jabba, when he does it, he's like, oh, like aware of it. And Watto just is like, what are you doing, man? Like, he doesn't even, like, put together that he's, like, trying
He's like, yeah, come on, give me a break.
Like, what are you doing? It is a little weird that, like, Sidious is like, yeah, just kill the Jedi with your robots, as if, like, he doesn't know that, like, that's not going to work. Like, that's...
Yes. I will grant you that. I was, like, trying to parse the plot, or, like, his, you know, scheme in this movie, and I was like, no, this is actually, like, a really bad plan.
Yeah, his plan sort of, like, keeps on getting thwarted, but, like, still comes together somehow. He's a lucky dude. He's just, like, I don't know. Like, he did not definitely, like, his plan wasn't like, oh, I'm going to attack these people so that they will then break the blockade and go to the desert planet where I may or may not have conceived of a conceived a child with midichlorians in the Force. And then they'll pick him up and bring him to me. Like, that could not have been the plan, but it ends up, like, working out for him.
Well, yeah, and that also bleeds into my next point.
Yeah, one other thing before we jump out of that is I did want to discuss a little bit, like, I've always been fascinated by the, like, prophecy of the, like, bringing balance to the Force and what that exactly means. Because different people will be like, well, Luke was actually the person to bring balance to the Force, you know, or whatever. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, the Force was all good. And it's just like, you're just misreading, like, I think, the prophecy. And just like, oh, balance to the Force would be like, now there's some good and evil, and they're on both sides. And, you know, when you've had, like, only good for centuries or whatever, and you get these complacent ass Jedis, and they're like, wait, what balance of the Force are you trying to bring about right now? Maybe this guy who turns out to be a Sith Lord is actually balancing things out, because you're winning right now. You don't maybe want it to be balanced. It's just like, oh, we want a balanced game. It's like, well, you don't want a balanced game when your team is up 50 points. I don't know. Just a thought on that. But, you know, there's lots of good, you know, Jedi universe building that takes place in this movie. And that includes a certain battle that is your next point of defense.
Yes, please. The Duel of the Fates, which is a title that I don't think people take literally enough.
Right. The ultimate lightsaber battle between Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan versus Darth Maul is the Duel of the Fates, set to the song Duel of the Fates by John Williams. So that's what it's known as. But yeah, it's a tremendous scene and has a lot going on with it.
Yes, and probably one of the best John Williams Star Wars cues.
Yeah, I think in the last episode we were talking, it's like definitely in the, I think it's in the top three, or, you know, it's it's like Imperial March, opening theme, probably Duel of the Fates in
Or maybe like
Force themes up there, you know, just.
Force theme,
Leia's theme is up there, but Luke's theme is up there, but
yeah, no, it's majestic. It's so unparalleled in how good it is.
It's epic in a way that those ones are not, partially because it has a chorus with it, but it is just a sweeping, like, you are, and in the movie it's like intercut between, kind of three battles that are, or four battles that are taking place. It's like the droids versus the Gungans, the lightsaber battle, the space battle where Anakin flies inside the Trade Federation ship and blows it up, and Queen Amidala taking back the, like, throne room from the viceroys and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I recall people were very critical of the cross-cutting in that whole section of the movie. Didn't bother me.
Yeah, it's one of those where I think they could work all separately, but then it would sort of be like, wait, what's the timeline of these? Because these are all
Yeah.
happening at the same time. Like, getting a just straight lightsaber battle totally works.
But it might have been too
Yeah.
much, you know? I think the intercutting works. So to double back on myself and what I said in the first episode, so Dave Filoni, who is basically the
He's the
guy
showrunner for
for Star
the
Wars right
Clone
now.
Wars animated show, and then was for The Mandalorian, and has sort of become like the, guy driving a lot of current Disney Star Wars content.
Yes, he also showruns Ahsoka and is getting to direct a movie, blah, blah,
Yeah,
blah.
and he has a much
Anyway.
deeper understanding of Star Wars than, say, J.J. Abrams. Just to throw out one person who may have created bad Star Wars content.
I'm more than happy to throw that man under the
He
bus.
sucks.
Yeah, he does. He has no original ideas.
He made the original Star Wars movies two times. He made A New Hope as a Star Trek reboot and as a Star Wars series reboot. Made it twice.
You said it and I didn't. All right. No, but Filoni's take on Duel of Fates, which kind of like broke my brain when I first
It's so
heard
good.
it.
He talked about it in a roundtable interview.
Yes, which I believe is on Disney Plus.
You can also just find it on YouTube. Probably just type it in.
Yeah. The fates at stake is like, who is going to raise Anakin? And it's either Obi-Wan or Qui-Gon. And the genius, I think, of the writing in the Phantom Menace is like, well, it should totally be Qui-Gon.
Right, he's the one who
This
believes
guy
in
has
him.
it.
He's the one who, it's like his cause.
He has it figured out. He's like the Jedi, capital T. Obi-Wan is his apprentice. He's still figuring things
Yeah, he's not a
out.
Jedi Master yet.
Nope. And so part of me is wondering if this was actually Palpatine's plan to have Qui-Gon killed and not Obi-Wan.
So yeah, the dynamic contrast between Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon at this point in episode one is very interesting, because Qui-Gon is sort of the wise, elder Jedi, and, knows a lot. He, in the movies, he's said to be the one who comes up with how to figure out how to do force ghosting and things like that. But he also is like this gruff rebel who, like, kind of hates, like, the bureaucracy and rules of this. And Obi-Wan's very much kind of still a stickler for the rules. He's like, I don't know, man. Like, Master Yoda said, like, not to do this. So, like, maybe we should just, like, listen to him. But then when they get to this duel of the fates, it sort of unlocks sort of the rageful side of Obi-Wan. Like, he basically, he sees Qui-Gon die and goes into, like, the rage that, is sort of the thing that, like, sends Anakin off the deep end eventually. And you're not supposed to do as a Jedi. You're not supposed to be that so emotionally attached that you're, like, raging and doing this. But, it ends up serving him. And, maybe that's some of the stuff that maybe seeps into when Anakin's his Padawan a little bit, because, Anakin also has to deal with, it's not said as much because you kind of jump ahead to, teenage Anakin in the next one. But Anakin has to deal with, like, the trauma of the man who saved him from slavery dying, without him being around. And just, you know, like last thing he said, he was just like, stay in that cockpit. Anakin saves the day. And then he's like, oh, where's my like Jedi dad? It's like, oh yeah, he's dead now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the first of many things that Anakin loses.
Yeah. I am so glad you brought this up, because one of the other things that really clicked with me on my most recent rewatch was like trying to parse Obi-Wan's character in episode 4 as we meet him.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of a broken man, and he's very unsure of if he should train Luke or even, you know, invite him into this whole, you know, spiel. And I think The Phantom Menace provides really good grounding for that, where it's like, oh man, okay, you weren't prepared for the job. You got the job, and then you kind of whiffed it.
Right.
And ended up, like, you know, maiming the guy.
Right, leaving him for dead on a volcano.
Yeah, and then that guy turned out to be, like, the worst villain in the universe. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you kind of missed the
ball. I mean, I also think you can translate some of the stuff, like, oh, it's a lot of the Qui-Gon teaching in him, like, when he, like, you know, when he gets the spark and he's like, oh, Luke, you should, like, come with me. And, like, you know, once things get in motion, he gets, like, very enthusiastic about teaching Luke the ways of the Force. And I think it's a lot of, like, A, it might be just, like, Qui-Gon's ingrained, like, hey, like, maybe he sees the again, different reading is the prophecy. It's like, oh, well, now maybe that wasn't this, and maybe this kid's the guy who could bring balance to the Force. I need a redemption tour. You know, I need to try again, and maybe I am old and grizzled now, and I, like, know where I messed up, and this can be sort of atonement for me screwing up.
Yeah, but that is kind of a fundamental problem of the sequel trilogy, right? It's like, Anakin does bring balance to the Force, you know? He sacrifices himself, and the Empire ends, and things are good.
Mm-hmm. And then they're bad again.
Yeah, somehow they're bad again. Somehow Palpatine...
Hand wave. They're bad again. There's a guy that's named Snoke that doesn't matter.
Yeah. One thing I did want to say that also struck me on my most recent rewatch was, so Anakin's a slave. I think that's weirdly important. Because it means that he's grown up in an environment where he's inured to a kind of servitude, right?
Right.
So from being, you know, Watto's slave to being... you know, a Jedi, and then into being a Sith, like, that's a clear line. Like, at no point is he his own master, you know? And I was like, oh, that is actually, like, a really kind of clever touch.
Yeah, the obvious is, like, oh, he went from enslavement under... Watto, who, I mean, I guess for a slave owner is pretty nice if we want to do that. But then it's just like, he's, you know, being basically Palpatine's slave to, you know, go out and do whatever bidding he wants. But that in-between time, it's just like, oh, yeah, you're also sort of the slave to this Jedi Order. It's maybe not one specific person, but it's this body that has this power over you and all the things that are your impulses of, like, love and, you know, trying to do the right thing sometimes when it's, like, not goes against code. It's just like, yeah, you're not following the rules because you're kind of our dude and you have to follow our rules because we sort of own you as the Jedis.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess they basically own him.
Yeah. I mean, it's strange.
Anyway, yeah, no, I agree completely. Yeah, their structures and everything, it's, yeah.
And I mean, we should also just say that, like, we're touching a lot on thematically, but also this lightsaber battle just, like, rules and was a very different thing than the prior lightsaber battles where, you know, there's,
so
you know,
much.
Like athleticism and, you know, you brought this up before, but it's just like, oh, you can... there's no longer George Lucas's rules of having to have two hands on a lightsaber like it's a samurai sword. You know, all these things. And also just some of the like shots, like, again, foreshadowing things that are good. Like when Darth Maul first attacks them on Tatooine, he only uses one blade of his saber. And you're like, you know, oh, that's a lightsaber. He has got a red lightsaber. Makes sense. Bad guys have red lightsabers. And then when you get to the start of the Duel of the Fates and those like cargo doors open up and Darth Maul's just sitting there,
baby.
And it's like, what ignition? Yeah. And you're like, oh no. And then it's two ignitions and you're like, oh fuck yeah, let's go.
One of the best shots in movie history? Probably.
It's definitely, it's a,
shouldn't have ruined it in the trailer.
Probably not. And yeah, that's one where if it wasn't in the trailer, you'd be like, what is happening? Two bladed lightsaber? Yeah. But yeah, I also understand why that's in the trailer when you're hyping things up. But yeah, that would have been a great reveal, pure reveal.
That would have been the best. That would have been the best.
And yeah, it's just like, it's choreographed so well. The added drama of like the doors closing and cutting off Obi-Wan.
Good. So
it's
good.
Like, oh yeah, this sort of so makes good. Sense. I'm not sure exactly what this space is and why there's these doors, but I'll go along with it because it's a fantasy epic.
Yeah, and I mean, just that fight, the only thing that comes remotely close would probably be the Empire fight with Vader and Luke, right? In terms of like stakes and just reversals and all those things.
Yeah, I mean, there's some good lightsaber battles, you know, but they're also, it's really interesting how they are so different across the movies. You know, like Return of the Jedi and Empire are like kind of on a similar path. Definitely the standout lightsaber battle in the sequel trilogy is the not a lightsaber battle against each other. It's when like Rey and Kylo Ren team up and just like lay waste.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then there's the Mustafar one in the third movie.
Yeah.
Which is also epic and great. But this one is like the most, I don't know, it's like the most in between like the classicalness of the original trilogy and then being like, oh, let's like kind of stunt this up and make it more, a little more cinematically interesting. I feel like this is sort of the midpoint Zen balance between those two things.
Yeah. And more to my point, like just like the stakes of it are massive, massive in a way that they aren't really in any, you know, subsequent.
It's truly a duel of the fates.
Exactly. And I think there was a reason that they used it in the Obi-Wan Disney Plus series like trailer.
Yeah. The song, where it's just like it's instantly like evokes something for Star Wars fans.
You're like, oh yeah, okay.
I know where we're going. I know the stakes just by this John Williams epic piece of music.
Precisely. Yeah.
But I mean, all those I think combine together to form a pretty strong defense for episode one.
I certainly hope I gave an adequate defense for what I think is a great movie in a year that had a lot of great movies.
Yeah, so let's get into the junk drawer and touch on a few more like random thoughts or maybe thoughts that we touched on before but are worth touching on again. You know, I think a good starting point is, you know, we talked about like how insane, you know, some of the technical aspects of this film are, and, you know, part of that, again, like leads to some of the wooden acting where it's just like, oh, these are also actors. The first time a lot of actors were on like fully green scene stages and like having to like deal with that. So that's also, you know, some of the technical advances and maybe some of the questionable performances kind of go hand in hand a little bit. If you're being forgiving on that end, I think. I'd also say I think that part of Natalie Portman's acting in this, I feel like it's maybe just being around so many like the George Lucas type, like stiff, regal, like Royal Shakespeare British actors, because it does feel like she's putting on more of like that stoic British regality in this one than in the subsequent films.
Yeah, and I would even admit that she doesn't necessarily get better in the subsequent films.
No, it's not Natalie Portman's finest moments, the Star Wars movies, but especially when like you do see Ewan McGregor getting so much better over the course of the movies that you're like, ugh, you're kind of like stuck in this spot.
And yeah, while we're in the junk drawer, let me just say again, it is fucking very cool of George Lucas to hire him off of Trainspotting
Yeah.
to be, Sir Alec.
Yeah, you know who you want to be this legendary character? The guy who was doing a lot of heroin.
Yeah. I think that is, pardon the pun, dope.
Wow. In terms of like 9-year-old flirting game, I think Are You an Angel is like a pretty good solid starting spot for.
Oh my God, I'm so mad. I was going to open the pod with that, and I regret it so
It's
much.
also it's just like it's so funny because it's like a little kid, like obviously like I don't have interactions with like females at my drunk trader life, and now all of a sudden this beautiful woman comes in and all of a sudden he's like, hey, you know, I'm like a pilot and I like built this whole droid and I can race pods, and oh, like there's a sandstorm coming, you guys should all come back to my place because it's bad and it's correct advice, but also it's like a little bit like, I don't know, it's a not baby it's cold outside, but baby it's sandy outside, you know.
Yes. And what is also funny is like now you have to wrap your mind around the idea that there are angels in the Star Wars universe.
Hey, that's introduction. I don't know where where exactly we land on this, but it's at least a concept that exists.
Yeah, I mean, he's a student of theology, and so I don't know.
Yeah. You know, maybe looking back now, this was it made sense to go to Tatooine on this movie because then it ties with, you know, Luke's origin story. But this is also before so many more Star Wars content things came about, and the general, like, why the fuck are we always going to Tatooine for every single one of these stories? Burnout occurred.
Yes.
So,
We have tax breaks to shoot in Jordan.
Hey, what can you do? And speaking sort of on the awards element that we talked about, where it was like the, oh, this lost to The Matrix for the sound awards and for best visual effects. There's some awards that this movie should have been up for. It also didn't win best score.
That's insane.
That's crazy. It went to, I think, The Red Violin.
I like that movie, but all right. Also wrong.
The
Yeah.
one that's absolutely crazy is this movie was not nominated for best costumes, which is
Okay, yes. And
bonkers.
you did bring this up in the
And I
last
want to bring it
pod.
up again and again until we get justice for the
I
amazing
mean
costume
for
work on this movie.
yes. Amidala.
Alone, just on the alone.
Alone.
Should have
Exactly.
been.
Like, give me a fucking break. Like, that is so goddamn
Right.
iconic.
And it's also a way that like this movie, you know, a lot of people focus on like the CGI-ness of this movie. There's so much like tactile practical filmmaking going on, like the level of investment in detail and like
Oh,
costumes.
tons.
Like I mentioned this before, but like there's a whole EMP, or I guess it's MoPOP now, exhibit in Seattle on the costumes of Star Wars. It was just like a fascinating thing and just like seeing how they were choosing certain fabrics and what they represent. And there was like so much thought that went into all of these. And it's just like, it's crazy. Again, not taking total shots at like other good movies, but like the talented Mr. Ripley was up for best costumes this year. And that's just kind of period piece, European, nice looking people.
Well,
I'm just saying,
yeah, and
like, in
that
terms
you
of,
can see what kind of
yeah,
wins.
I'm just
Yeah.
saying, in terms of like degree of difficulty, Topsy Turvy won for best costumes, but it's just like,
Okay. Yeah.
you know, some of those things. I would also point out that the movie that won Best Picture this year is way worse than The Phantom Menace.
Oh, I know the movie you're talking about, and I won't say its name.
That would be.
Or its lead actor.
I will say its name. That movie is American Beauty, and that movie sucks. It's so bad. It's
Yeah.
so bad. It's like
Yeah.
cringy, like not even laughably bad. You're like, I can't believe. Because also, I did not see that movie at the time it came out. I just saw it think within the past year, and I'm like, people thought this was good. This is like, putting the Kevin Spaceyness of it aside, people thought this was good. It's very bad.
It is absolutely insane that in 1999, that was what the Academy was like. This is the best movie.
Star Wars Episode One, The Phantom Menace, is so much better than that movie. It's like not comparable. Yeah. They're not comparable. It's even hard to like even come up with a comparison. It's like a whatever the worst Netflix Adam Sandler movie is, like winning over Fury Road or something. It's like,
yeah,
it's so bad. But yeah, and also there's so much of like stuff that's iconically influenced, like the shields that the Gungans have for the Battle of Naboo. It's like, oh, yeah, that is 100% like Battle of Wakanda shield stuff that comes up later.
Yep, they ripped it off. Yep, Captain America.
There's so many things that like Marvel eventually takes from this. There are plenty of things to like nitpick that are fun also about this movie. Like, why in the ship that Anakin gets into and eventually does it, why is there a kid-sized helmet in that? In the cockpit of that? That seems a little weird. Like, there's a confusing moment where, like, Padme switches back to the Queen when she's on Coruscant, and then, like, initially is, like, when they get on the ship is still Padme, but then, like, switches. It's just, like, it's a weird, like, wouldn't Obi-Wan, Anakin, and Qui-Gon be like, hey, didn't we leave the handmaiden that was like your right-hand handmaiden? She's like not on board right now. That's weird, right?
Yeah.
So a little bit of that. Also, Jar Jar at one point, again, this is Jar Jar parlance, but he says that the Queen's being super nice to Anakin, and he's like, that's pretty hot. Like, pretty hot, which apparently is like Gungan for like cool, but it sounds like he's just like saying that Padme's hot, which is weird from Jar Jar, but I don't know.
That is weird, but they seem to have a consensual relationship later. Yeah. He's a senator. Mm-hmm. She's a senator, you know?
Yeah, and there's some things where you can get hung up on, like, wait, exactly why can't they transmit at certain times? And then how are they traced if they weren't transmitting? So were they transmitting?
They have to get to Tatooine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, but it's just like, there's some of those stuff where you could...
Don't ask me about C-3PO.
What about C-3PO?
We don't talk about C-3PO.
In this household, we do not talk about C-3PO.
No, yeah. Yeah, you know, it's an imperfect movie, but a movie I adore and I'm more than happy to extemporate with you about.
One final little detail, which is fun, which is pre, again, Marvel end scenes. At the very end of the credits, there's just a Vader breath, which is just such a nice detail.
Yeah. I love Lucas, man. Like, he had the juice.
Well, I think that covers your defense of The Phantom Menace. Is there anything you would like to plug on your way out, Jason?
Well, I would absolutely like to plug my article about The Phantom Menace, which should be publishing in the Inlander.
It's online now to read at inlander.com. Jason did a essay on sort of The Phantom Menace's lasting effect. Oh, we should probably also mention before we get out of here that, like, because of the age gaps, we talked a little bit about the age gaps, the Star Wars prequels, big on Gen Z TikTok and all that stuff. They are much more beloved among younger audiences than the old, you know, crusty folks who really hated them when they came out.
I am very happy that you shoved that into my article, because I was re-listening to our initial podcast and I was like, oh, yeah, you brought this up then as well. Yeah, it is wild that these movies took off.
Yeah, I mean, there is an inherent, like, memeability of the sequels, sometimes in, like, kind of silly, slightly cringe ways, and sometimes in, like, just more like, oh, the kids just really attach to this ways. But you can go online and, you know, if your algorithm likes it, you know, you could get a lot of Star Wars prequel content in the year 2024 filtering through your timeline.
Oh, totally. And I think that's absolutely why we got the Obi-Wan show. Yeah.
Which, but hey.
Yeah, I know. Same. could have been better. Yeah. But
it wasn't the worst thing. It wasn't the Boba Fett show, but it was still not good.
Well, Andor season two, knocking wood.
Hopefully, good. Hopefully, more good Star Wars content is coming down the pipeline. Though it's always a touch and go, especially after movie number 9 sucked.
And hey, Rogue Squadron, let's do it.
Hopefully. Anything else you want to plug?
Read my article about The Matrix.
Oh yeah, speaking of 1999, you can also Jason wrote about The Matrix's anniversary as well. Lots of anniversaries because it's the 25th year of one of the biggest movie years. So there's a lot of stuff to check out there. And you can just follow the pod on socials and stuff. And I don't have anything else going on. So, yeah. May the 4th be with you, Jason, and everyone listening. And remember, even if everyone else mocks it, love the stuff you love.
May the 4th be with you, Seth.